This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. There was a time, not long ago and not in some galaxy far, far away, when being called a geek was to be labeled a social pariah, forever banished from the land of the cool, where the popular kids in high school, from the equally stereotypical captain of the football team to the homecoming queen, ruled their kingdom from on high and relegated geeks to, at best, invisibility, and at worst, hazing and ridicule. But the times, as Bob Dylan, probably not a geek, once sang, are a-changin'. And geeks these days are everywhere, in positions of power, driving the world of high tech, making science and science fiction seem cool, even showing up in top-rated TV sitcoms.
Warlord beats Troll, Troll beats Elf, Elf beats Water Sprite, and basically everything beats Enchanted Bunny.
Unless you have the carrot of power.
Okay, I've got another question. When does this get fun?
Are we going to talk or are we going to play Mystic Warlords of Ka'a?
That exchange from the wildly successful comedy The Big Bang Theory illustrates how geeks in the early part of the 21st century are not just thriving but asserting themselves. And it also shows how big a divide there is still between the worlds populated by passionate geeks and the ones who just don't get it, whatever it is. And so today, on Vermont Edition, we're asking just who or what is a geek? And what does it mean to be a geek in a state like Vermont, where it's not exactly the first word that comes to mind when describing the kind of person who lives in a place known for dairy farming, outdoor recreation, and neo-bohemian living? Well, helping us get our geek on today are three out and proud geeks, Andrew Liptak, a Burlingtonian and co-founder of the group Geek Mountain State. He's also editor of the new anthology War Stories, New Military Science Fiction. Andy, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Also in our Colchester studios is Kristen Dearborn of Essex Junction, a horror fiction writer and author of the books Trinity and Sacrifice Island. Her work has also appeared in a number of horror compilations. Kristen, great to have you with us today.
It's great to be here.
And joining us from our studios in Brattleboro is Brian Staveley of Marlboro, author of The Emperor's Blades and The Providence of Fire. Thanks for joining us as well, Brian.
Happy to be here.
And we want you to join the conversation, whether you consider yourself a geek or not. What is your experience living as a geek in Vermont, or perhaps trying to get into a geek circle and wondering just how that's accomplished? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211 or send us an email via our Facebook page or by writing to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. So, guys, let's get to it. And, Andy, I want to start with you. I mean, if you had to describe in a thumbnail easily, like, what a geek is, what is a geek?
It's whatever you make of it, really. I think part of it is a shared passion for science fiction, fantasy, technology, science, and the list goes on. I think a lot of it comes down to enthusiasm and passion.
Well, that's the thing. Does it have to be in those realms? Because you just mentioned science fiction and fantasy, that sort of thing. That's what people think of. But can you be a geek like a baseball geek, somebody who's totally into stats about baseball, that kind of thing?
Or in Burlington, a beer geek. There's plenty right. of people who really, you know, get really into the making of it or the collecting or drinking or consuming in various ways. I think that it all applies equally.
You know, it's not considered a nice word, geek. It's always had that bad connotation. Do you consider it, a bad thing, or do you like a badge of honor now these days?
No, I've never seen it as a bad thing. My experience might not be the same as most people out there. I was never really bullied for it or really had any problems with it in high school. I was not really I wasn't the only person in my high school who liked science fiction, and certainly not in college. So I think that your mileage may vary a little bit. But I think it's a good term, and it's something I just use to describe myself quite a bit.
Kristen Dearborn, you know, in some ways you're our most interesting member of the panel today. You're the only woman on the panel here. You write horror fiction. I understand you ride a motorcycle too?
I do, yes.
These are not things that people would associate with your typical geek.
Oh, I think horror is plenty geeky. That gets lumped in pretty frequently in speculative fiction with science fiction and fantasy. I think a big piece of what makes geeks is imagination, and I think that as much as enthusiasm is a big part of geekdom.
Do you see any difference between a geek and, let's say, a nerd? Would anybody ever call you a nerd?
I would think of geek as being more on that fantasy side, and a nerd being more grounded in facts. I don't know.
More statistically oriented, let's say?
Sure.
Okay. Brian Staveley, let me ask you. You're there from our studios in Brattleboro, and I understand that you consider yourself a fringe geek. Is that right? And if so, what does that mean?
Well, there's a hard core to the world of geekdom that I'm not sure that I fully have access to. Just to go back briefly to the question of whether or not the word is positive, you know, it goes back to the 1600s, even the 1500s, where it was unambiguously an insult. It was this word geek, and it meant sort of an idiot or a simpleton. And then that got translated in the early 20th century into sort of not just an idiot, but a freak, someone outside the norm. And it was particularly used for circus performers. And it wasn't until the latter half of the 20th century that it kind of took on its current meaning. And so it's kind of – I think the word has been on a 500-year course of rehabilitation. It's just getting better and better. But as to my fringe geekness, I think that geeks often are so passionately involved in some individual thing that they can lose sight of the rest of the world, right? That's one of the hallmarks of it. And I've been too busy doing a lot of things to dive as much as I'd like to into one particular thing.
You know, you were mentioning the roots of the word geek, and you mentioned circus performers. Unless I'm mistaken here, I think it was literally a performer who used to bite the heads off chickens. Is that right?
Yes, there is. That's one of the early recorded usages from the 20th century.
Well,
but it goes back, as I said, further than that even.
Even further than that.
Yeah.
Kristen, does that image, you know, of that circus performer doing that scary thing that maybe Ozzy Osbourne made popular in many later years fit really well into that genre of horror? And what got you into writing horror fiction?
Well, I've always been enthusiastic about horror fiction. Some of my early influences would be those Alvin Schwartz's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark with those wonderful grisly illustrations, and also James Howe's Banicula books about a vampire rabbit who's adopted by a family.
Oh, that sounds great.
They are great.
They're funny.
It's so good. It didn't take long before I graduated up to Stephen King. I grew up in Maine, so he's kind of a staple. And it just kind of went from there.
Can I ask, in high school, junior high school, you know, you were into this stuff back then, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have trouble fitting in? Did you want to be in the popular clique or that kind of thing?
I had my own group of friends that I hung out with. We did things like theater and yearbook. We were our own little group. I went to a relatively small school, and there weren't really enough people to be super exclusive. A lot of the so-called jocks were in our school plays, and there was a lot of overlap.
A lot of crossover.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew, I want to ask about you're the founder of Geek Mountain State. And, you know, this brings up the question of what does it mean to be a geek in the state of Vermont? As I said at the top here, you know, Vermont is considered an outdoor place. You know, you don't think of people with pocket protectors or the stereotypical geek image. What does it mean to be a geek here in Vermont, and what are the opportunities for geeks here?
Well, we don't have pocket protectors, at least not that I've seen.
You don't have one right now.
No, I'm pocket protectorless. The site came about a couple years ago, 2010, when a friend of mine and I had a conversation over IM about how, you know, there's a lot of things that we like to do, but there's not really any central clearinghouse for them. So what we were finding is that, you know, there's a lot of people who do games. There's the Green Mountain Gamers, and there's various game stores that hold games in their stores. But there's also things like there's concerts from so-called like nerd musicians like Marion Call or MC Frontalot that had come through, and we wanted sort of a place to stick them. So there's a lot of the stuff that goes on under the hood that we didn't really see a lot of visibility for. So we started, you know, just posting this stuff up online, and as we have been doing that, we've been finding that there's more and more and more. So that, you know, as much as there's opportunities for skiing and brew pubs and things like that, there's a lot of things that you can find that will appeal to somebody who likes gaming, who likes science fiction, fantasy, and stuff in the news as well. Like there's a new barcade opening up in Burlington, for example. Stuff like that we started to cover, and there's a lot there. You turn over a rock and you find a new author, or you find a new story that they've written, or artist, things like that.
So there's opportunities in Burlington. But Brian Stavely, I understand that you're a little frustrated down there in Brattleboro. When you want to get your geek on, you come up to Burlington. Is that right?
Yeah, you have to work a little bit harder down here, I'd say. And not necessarily because there aren't serious geeks down here, but just there's a lower population density. And so I was delighted when I discovered Geek Mountain State and the website, and that there was this whole clearinghouse of information, because you could walk up and down a lot of dirt roads down here before you found somebody who wanted to dress up in a Dragonlance costume and shoot arrows at a tree.
It seems to me that because of so much of what happens in geekdom happens online, that maybe it really doesn't matter where you live. I mean, is this really a virtual world for people? Because Andrew's shaking his head no here. He wants to jump in. I'll let all of you answer that. But go ahead, Andrew.
I don't think so. One of the things that we've started doing with Geek Mountain State is doing live events, like in-person stuff. And we found that those are really important.
What kind of stuff are we talking about here?
Well, there's gaming matches all over the place. Vermont just had its first Comic-Con earlier this year. We've had some other smaller conventions like Carnage, and there's an anime convention. I can't remember what its name is off the top of my head. But we started doing author events from local science fiction fantasy authors. We've had both Kristen and Brian up. I've read for them. And we've done some panel discussions with the Burlington Book Festival. And we're stuff like that. And what we've been finding is that you get people together in the same room, they start talking to one another. And it's a different type of conversation than you have online, where you're sort of just sending information back and forth. You don't get the body language and the side conversations as while you're doing that. But you have all these other conversations just starting up. And I've been inspired by the people I've been talking to, and I know that other people have as well. And now we start to talk more, and in-person stuff is much more important, I think.
You mentioned gaming, and I know that this has been a really touchy subject in the news recently, especially for women who want to get more into gaming. And, yes. And Kristen, are you into gaming? Do you play a lot of video games, or is it not your thing?
I do some. I'm not a fan of multiplayer, mostly because I'm a really bad gamer, and I just
same here.
Want
don't
to
worry.
Be by myself. I actually used to be the assistant manager of one of the GameStops here, so I do play a lot of single-player stuff.
What about, though, I'm sure you followed the news on this, the misogyny and a lot of what's been written that's come out here against women, some really terrible things online. And I think this speaks to what Andrew was saying about, you know, the geek community doesn't have to be online separated by, you know, you can't see the person. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something about seeing people in person, the way you act when you're with someone civilly.
Yeah, and I think that when you're online, when you're posting in a message group, when you're playing games with somebody online, and it dehumanizes them, and you can say all sorts of things that you wouldn't say to somebody's face. I think that the online experience, you can meet people from all around the world, you can have great relationships with them, but I do prefer in-person meetings, and I really like that Andrew and his group have brought the geeks together.
Out of the shadows, let's say. Yeah. We are talking geeks today, and if you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Are you a geek? Do you consider yourself a geek? Would you like to be a geek? Is there a way you want to get into the geek culture? We've got some folks here who can tell you just how to do that. You can call 1-800-639-2211 or send us an email via our Facebook page or by writing to vermontedition@vpr.net. So, Brian Stavely, we've talked about how it can be a little bit difficult to be a rural geek, perhaps in the southern part of the state where you are. But all three of our guests today are writers. You're a writer. Tell me something about how you got into writing and what were some of the earliest influences you had that you considered geek writers, let's say.
Well, as a kid, really starting in junior high, I guess, I was just a voracious reader of fantasy and science fiction. I always had a paperback open underneath my desk during math class, during French class, during any class. And I was a much faster reader then than I am now. And so I would tear through these novels sort of like four or five a week. But then I wrote poetry for a long time in college and grad school, and I only sort of returned – I read fantasy all through them, but I only really returned to writing fantasy in my 30s. So when you mentioned earlier that I considered myself a fringe geek, that's one of the reasons, is that I was unfaithful to the fantasy genre for a while. but I've come back. I've come back, and the love is stronger than ever.
All is forgiven. And this is where I can start to relate. In a lot of ways, I don't consider myself a geek. I don't play video games at all. I don't see the appeal. But I do remember in junior high school discovering Harlan Ellison. And that just changed my life. I mean, his short stories blew me away. I've never read a writer like that who sounded like he was screaming inside my head and, of course, literally screaming. I wonder about some of the folks that you guys like to read. Andrew, who are some of your favorite writers?
Well, I started in high school like Brian did. Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, mm-hmm. And then through college, I sort of took a bit of a break, but then I started getting more into it on a critical level and started reading a lot of newer authors. So authors like Paolo Bacigalupi and Anne Leckie come to mind as newer upcoming writers that have basically drawn on this tradition of science fiction fantasy writing and have been writing some really great critical books about all sorts of things.
And Kristen, obviously you read Stephen King, but mm-hmm. there must have been some others too.
Yeah, certainly. Back in high school, I read a lot of Dean Koontz, John Saul. Horror had quite an explosion in the 80s, where those lurid mass market paperbacks were just everywhere. The genre is still kind of reeling from that and trying to reimagine itself. But I was always getting those little paperbacks out of the library, reading those. I went to graduate school at Seton Hill University, which distinguishes itself with its Master of Writing Popular Fiction. So it's an academic program that focuses on horror, science fiction, fantasy, romance, mystery, and really looks at that in an academic eye. And so we're forced to read a lot with it, both within our genres and also reading in other genres.
Well, we've got an email. We got a lot coming in on our Facebook page. We heard from H2O Lady, who said, teaching mathematics to junior high and senior high school students over the years, I would tell my students that the students they called geeks and or nerds today, they would be calling them boss in 15 years. It looks like she was right. Before we head to a break, I want to ask Brian Stavely briefly. Brian, you know, these writers we mentioned, the genre fantasy, science fiction, horror, Do they still to this day, because I know it's been true in the past, sort of, you know, get looked down upon by, you know, the fans of true or real literature?
Well, it's a really interesting question. As I said, in college and grad school, I was studying poetry, and so I've seen it from both sides of the fence. Hmm. I'm not sure that they get looked down on so much as that they're just a subject of perplexity. I would say that some of my friends who are poets sort of look just in bafflement at you're reading this book where there's a huge dragon on the cover and there's this person who seems to be being, you know, turned blue over here. Like, well, why is that even a thing? I haven't encountered a lot of snobbery about it, but just perplexity. And I guess, you know, it goes both ways, right? You take somebody who doesn't read a lot of poetry, they are absolutely totally perplexed as to why you would have a little book of poetry, you know, anywhere in your house, really. So I see it just more – there's just a gap between people's interests.
We're talking about geeks today on Vermont Edition. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. We've got much more coming up right after a break. We're going to get into a little bit of Star Wars, Star Trek talk. We've got some strong opinions on that here. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. And we're getting our geek on today, talking about what makes a geek and whether Vermont could be a geek mountain state. What are your definitions of a geek? Are they forces for good or evil? Can anyone be a geek, or is it a special club for very smart and specialized people? Our guests today are Andy Liptak, writer of the blog Geek Mountain State, also horror writer Kristen Dearborn, and writer Brian Stavely of Marlboro. We want to hear from you as well. 1-800-639-2211 to get your geek on today on Vermont Edition, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We are getting a lot of folks who are writing in. We heard from Stephen Ludlow, who posted on Facebook saying, I moved to Vermont after 16 years of geeking for the government in D.C. It's been 10 years now. Not all the technology we worked on is out on the open market now. The hardest part, he says, is hearing someone in a store selling a computer and misrepresenting the hardware specs, etc., and not stepping in to correct them. Yes, I imagine that would be difficult to do. Andrew Liptak, we were talking in the middle of the break there about your experience of encountering, let's say, snobbery when we talk about fiction and you know, what's considered real or you know, educational. What's been experience with that?
There's a lot of conventions, science fiction conventions, fantasy conventions that talk about this quite a lot. And I think a lot of the – snobbery is one word. It probably depends on who you talk to. But going back to throughout science fiction's history, you have this genre and body of literature that's rooted in like really kind of terrible writing and pulp magazines from the like 1920s, 30s, 40s. And I think that a lot of that stigma from those stories lingers today. So you have a lot of really great science fiction that's been written since then and a lot of changes in the genre. And that is not always the first thing people think of. You think science fiction, you think a guy with a ray gun shooting a blob-headed alien. And that's not – that's certainly there's still stuff like that written. But there's a lot of other very thoughtful, very very well-written science fiction fantasy stories that are some of the best things that are written right now and are getting a lot of critical acclaim. So I think that's starting to change. But predominantly, I think that there's still this idea of that science fiction is still sort of relegated to the pulps. Mm-hmm. And it's not really the case anymore.
Well, there's an interesting dynamic, which is that if somebody writes a fantasy or sci-fi book that's – or a horror novel that's really good, mm-hmm. That's really well crafted, it doesn't end up on the horror or the sci-fi and fantasy shelf. Mm-hmm. It ends up on the literature shelf. So you can sort of poach Margaret Atwood or Ursula Le Guin or whoever and say, okay, well, once it hits a certain level, it's no longer – fantasy anymore. It's now literature. And that, that keeps the two separated also.
Chris and I were actually just talking about this before we came in, and there's a great book out right now called the Southern Reach Trilogy by Jeff Vandermeer. And I'd actually stopped by before to look for it in Barnes & Noble, and I looked in the science fiction section, couldn't find it. It's actually in the fiction section, and
exactly.
it's way in the back. So they're definitely very science fictional books.
We're going to take a phone call now. Let's go to Nick in St. Albans. Hi, Nick. How you doing?
Hey, how are you, sir?
Great. What's your question for our panel today?
Well, not really a question, just a comment. Thank mm-hmm. you for taking my call. Big VPR fan and NPR fan as well, and I just wanted to kind of let all the listening geeks out there know that it's okay. I kind of tried to shield it through high school, going towards athletics, and it really wasn't something it made me happy for a while, but it really wasn't where my true passion was. And I guess I'm a huge video gamer. However, I kind of break the norm. I went into the infantry in the army and whatnot. And it's just I just wanted people to know that it's really okay to go with your passions and they shouldn't really feel bad about what it is that they do.
Thank you, Nick. I appreciate that call very much. Good to know. It's all okay. Let's go to Ross in Saranac Lake. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Mitch. How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
So I guess my comment's along sort of the same lines as what the guy just before me said, but you had said something about how you wondered if geeks were a specifically typecast type of person or if there were all sorts of different kinds of geeks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say that I'm most definitely a geek in the fact that I read more than almost anyone I know. Most of what I read is science fiction, fantasy, horror, pretty much among lines of what you've been talking about. But in high school and through life, I was always one of the better-looking, more popular jock types. I played football in high school, lacrosse, all that kind of stuff. So I would say that geeks are definitely not one type of person, but could be absolutely anyone.
Well, one of the things that's been coming out that's geeky, whether people want to admit it or not, is that the popularity of fantasy football, that's like a perfect
right.
marriage of geeky stats and sports.
Ross, would you consider fantasy football a geeky thing?
Well, my sister, who's a few years older than me, had never seen a single football game in her life until she moved to Alabama. Her husband got a job at Bama State.
Well, then you're required to, yeah. So
she's now a super football geek. So, yeah, I would say that definitely could be considered a geek quality.
Well, Ross, thank you very much for the call, and thank you for not persecuting geeks in high school. I think that's a good thing. Let's take a call. Donna is on the line from Fairfax. Hi, Donna.
Well, Ross, thank you very much. Yes. Hello. Thank you for having me. This is a wonderful program. I just wanted to concur with many other comments that I have been, if you want to call it a geek, since third grade when I was introduced to Madeleine L'Engle's Wrinkle mm-hmm. in Time books.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, classics.
And never looked
yep.
back
mm-hmm.
and have read, I poured through Andre Norton all through high school. And came on to Ursula Le Guin, of course, and Orson Scott Card and Lois McMaster Bujold later, now. And it's just been what I read, for all the time. We still get Science News Magazine to our house, and I'm now at the point where I could have grandchildren if my children would provide that. But it's just been a wonderful, and I've introduced my kids. They are science fiction readers, and I am currently, I'm a pastor, and I must say that every now and then there are aspects of science fiction and the fantasy that creep into sermons, and because it's all a part of life. Mm.
Donna, thank you very much for that call. And offline, give us the names of your kids, and we'll get them on that right away so you can get some grandchildren. I want to get to something before we run out of time, guys. And, you know, we got a little time here. I want to get all your thoughts on this. And this is where I think geeks get into the subcategories of geekdom, okay? Because geeks are passionate about science fiction. We've all heard about the books and stuff we love. But within that world, you have very hard and fast thoughts and opinions on things. Now, we all know Star Wars because it came out. It was this huge hit. It's become cultural icons. Everyone quotes from the movies. And Star Trek also. Now, I want to get from all of you what you think briefly about which is superior, Star Wars or Star Trek, and then I will tell you why each of you are right or wrong. Andy, let's start with you.
Star Wars, easily.
Okay. Kristen, let's go with you.
Star Wars.
Oh, my God. Brian.
The Iliad. No, Star Wars also.
So all three of you need an education. You're very smart people. You're wonderful writers. Here's the thing. I don't understand how you can take Star Wars over Star Trek when Star Trek has A, prompted so many other genres. It's lasted for decades and decades, and it's gone to different TV shows and movies, etc. And there are so many flaws in Star Wars itself. And let's start with the one I want all of you to explain. If any of you can explain to me here why we were supposed to be so afraid of Darth Vader, the Stormtroopers, and the Death Star when somebody built the Death Star and decided to put in an automatic self-destruct target that with one shot could ruin the entire thing.
Well, that's what happens when you have a contractor that goes the lowest bidding process. You have these little mistakes that crop up. But you know,
a little mistake.
I think we have one of those in my house.
One of the things with the Stormtroopers, you think about how the sequence of events goes in A New Hope. They were deliberately missing all their shots. They let everybody get away.
Oh, is that why they moved like Rock'em Sock'em Robots? They had these laser guns, but they never hit anything.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm, it's also hard to see in those helmets, and I know from experience.
I was just terrified of them. Kristen, why Star Wars over Star Trek?
I'm a character-driven person myself. Mm. I resonate more with the Star Wars characters. Han Solo, Leia, Chewie. I would take them over Kirk and Picard.
Wow. And Brian, any reason you can tell me why Star Wars is superior to Trek?
Well, I have the best excuse, which is that I'm a fantasy writer, so that's where my allegiances lie. And it's been said before, not by me, that Star Wars is basically not science fiction at all. It's just fantasy in space.
Thank you. That is true.
And so I have to, you know, I have to go with my genre.
I will tell you all that, you know, and I guess you could probably point out this same flaw in Star Trek, but one of the things that really annoyed me about Star Wars when I first saw it, and again, I was a geek at the time and I was angry about this, but, you know, there's the science part of science fiction, and explosions don't make sound in space. Space is a vacuum. Can we all agree on that?
Oh, Star Wars ignores all the science.
Yeah, all the science. Brian, thank you for saying it. So you guys just like it for the fun, and I'm just taking it too seriously. That's basically
I'm with Kristen, the story, the characters, but yeah, you can't go there for hard science.
Boy, the relationship between Kirk and Spock, I'm sorry, that is a real bromance, and I think you guys should revisit the entire trip.
Come on, Chewie and Han.
Chewie doesn't say much beyond
Oh, he says plenty. You just don't understand.
Okay. I am glad that I have perhaps been educated myself. Now, of course, we're getting other, you know, I'm getting messages here from Rick Sangari, our producer, who's saying, what about Lost in Space or The Time Tunnel? Any opinions on that?
I actually haven't seen Time Tunnel.
Lost in Space, Robbie the Robot.
Probably knows very little.
Danger Will Robinson.
I remember watching when I was a kid, but it didn't stick with me the way that some others did.
Are there any depictions of science fiction or fantasy, though, that really do offend you as writers, you know, that you just think that got into the popular culture that really didn't deserve to be there?
Well, actually, Star Wars is a really good example of that. I'm a big fan of it, but it has such a big cultural influence that it creates a lot of misconceptions about how, you know, you don't have sound in space. You can't have lasers like they do. Like, you know, scientifically, it's, you know, not possible. But it's probably responsible for a lot of the misconceptions that come afterwards, especially in other films and movies.
And what about you, Kristen? Do you think there's anything out there that's just not – doesn't up to par, let's say?
I'm thinking about some of the horror light that's been very popular lately with – vampires as romantic icons as opposed to scary monsters. Some of that, it's not what I like to read. It gets people reading, so I'm for it in that aspect, but it's not my cup of tea.
Brian Stavely, we've just got about a minute here, but I want to just jump off that thought, excuse me, for a second, and ask you, you know, when you talk about these things like zombies, vampires. I mean, that's werewolves. That seems to be all there is. When is something new going to come out, perhaps from the three of you, that's going to grab people, a new kind of monster or something that we can all get behind?
I think there's new stuff coming out literally every week. You just have to dig. You don't even have to dig. You just need to go to the bookstore and chat with your little local bookstore owner. Go to the library and say, hey, what's new? Go online. There are great innovative monsters, spaceships, artificial intelligences, monsters. We're all working hard to make that happen every week, and it's out there.
And finally, do all three of you believe that geekdom has really turned a corner in the 21st century here, that now it's cool, it's accepted?
Yeah,
yes,
I think so.
Absolutely. I think if you look at the box office results, President Obama's a geek. I think we're pretty mainstream.
Well, it's been a lot of fun talking geeks with you guys today, and I think we can all be proudly geeky today. And I want to thank you all for coming in. We've been speaking with Andrew Liptak, who is the co-founder of the group Geek Mountain State, editor of the new anthology War Stories, New Military Science Fiction. Also, Kristen Dearborn, horror writer and author of the books Trinity and Sacrifice Island, and Brian Stavely, author of The Emperor's Blades and The Providence of Fire. Thank you all so much for coming in and being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And also, I should point out that we have some links that we're going to show on our webpage at vpr.net if you want to find out some of the readings that are coming up. Andrew, you were mentioning that before. There's all sorts of events happening in the world of geekdom. So we're going to have that for you. Coming up, Vermont's Deputy Secretary of the Agency of Agriculture tells us how many Vermont dairy farmers took advantage of the new National Insurance Dairy Program and whether the deadline for signing up might be extended even further. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. The latest iteration of the federal Farm Bill created an insurance program for dairy farmers that takes milk prices and prevailing feed costs into account. The deadline to sign up for the insurance had been extended several times, with this past Friday being the final deadline. And joining us now to update us on how many Vermont farmers took advantage of the Margin Protection Program, or MPP, is Deputy Secretary of the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Diane Bothfeld. Diane, thanks so much for being with us on Vermont Edition today.
Thank you, Mitch.
Now, we have 874 dairy farms in the state of Vermont. Of those, how many have enrolled in the new Margin Protection Program?
Well, we've had a pretty good percentage of farms taking part, with 597 farms have signed up to cover their risk for 2015.
And do those figures include catastrophic coverage, which they'd get for the $100 application fee?
Yes, it does. And out of the number who signed up for the catastrophic, there were 357 that chose to buy up more insurance and increase their risk protection.
Now, ideally, you'd probably like to have every dairy farm sign up for the protection. Are you pleased with the numbers, though, that did come out?
Yes, I am. I think it's important every farmer had to make their individual choice. I think it's really important that 738 out of our 874 dairy farmers made some connection with the USDA Farm Service Agency. They came in, they sat down, they kicked the tires, they understood the program, and not everybody made the choice to sign up, but at least we had 84% of Vermont's dairy farms get the information they needed about the program and then be able to make their individual decision on whether to take part or not.
Well, for those who did opt into the program, did they give reasons for being a part of it and why they wanted to be?
I think it was really important to have these extensions of the deadline to the 19th. There's no expectation of any more extensions. I think that's it. But at least farmers got a chance to see the predictions of milk prices and feed costs for 2015. And those milk prices are definitely headed downward in all the predictions. And so I think that really helped farmers with the extension to say, wow, I better make sure I cover my risk and to take part. Most farms I talked with said it was fairly affordable, and also they had been through low milk price times before, and it was very hard on the farm financially, and this was one way to protect that financial risk for the farm.
For those, though, who decided not to take part in the MPP, did they say why?
Well, I think it's a new program for some. It depends on the individual farm situation. If there isn't a lot of debt carried by the farm, they may be able to weather a milk price turn down better than other farms that may have a higher debt load. Also, there is one other program called Livestock Gross Margin Insurance, which some farmers chose. We had 25 farms in Vermont choose to use that type of risk protection. So a couple of different reasons, but for some, maybe the cost and being unsure of what choice to make on this coverage level.
And Diane, how do the numbers compare to the national figures? You know, how many farmers around the state outside of Vermont signed up as compared with here?
I've been searching for those numbers, Mitch, this morning, and maybe people have taken an early holiday, but I can't seem to find any numbers from other states right now. Our USDA Farm Service Agency office here in Vermont was great sharing the numbers, and you know, they kept us updated week by week, but I haven't been able to find those other numbers from other parts of the state. I spoke to some different states last week on a different conference call, and they said it was going slowly, but they were seeing some gaining momentum toward the end with the deadline looming and the predictions of milk prices. So they were hopeful that their numbers would come up, but definitely nothing official on signups around the country at this point.
Now, you mentioned that the deadline has been extended a few times, and you said it is not going to be extended again. When will dairy farmers have the opportunity, though, to sign up again for this insurance?
That comes next July. That begins the next sign-up period for 2016. So this was it. Last Friday was it for signing up for coverage in 2015. The beginning for coverage for 2016 sign-up starts in July of next year.
And briefly, Diane Bothfeld, what would you tell dairy farmers about this insurance if they didn't opt in this time that might convince them to take it on the next time around?
I think it's going to be really important if we have a poor milk price year with feed costs going potentially up somewhat. You never know is there going to be a drought? Is there going to be storms that, you know, reduce people's feed amount? That this is just similar to having insurance on the barn for fire or having insurance on your car. You hope you don't have an accident, but if you do, you've got coverage. So I think some farms may sit back and watch this year, and they have a tough year if milk prices go to where they're predicted. So you can watch, but I hope you learn if there's a trouble with milk prices that this is the program to help mitigate your risk.
Diane Bothfeld is Vermont's Deputy Secretary of Agriculture. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
And finally today, when Governor Shumlin announced that the state was facing a $100 million deficit earlier this year, one thing that was immediately on the chopping block: funding for the Vermont Veterans Home in Bennington. The home has been in financial trouble for years. It received over $1 million from the general fund in 2014 alone. Last week, the board of the Veterans Home met to discuss cost-saving measures. They decided to reduce their capacity from 170 beds to 130. Jane Lindholm spoke with Melissa Jackson, CEO of the Vermont Veterans Home, about that decision.
And the reason for doing that is sort of twofold. One is that you haven't actually been filling all of the beds, but also this will result in a significant tax reduction for you?
Yes. Nursing homes pay what's called a Medicaid bed tax on each of our licensed beds, whether there's a veteran or member in that bed. And by reducing our census for beds that we're not able to fill, we're going to save approximately $201,000 a year on the tax alone.
Your total budget gap is $3.5 million, though. So what are you going to do to get there?
We also have 13 open positions. Those are positions that are not filled because our census is low. And by not filling those positions, we'll save $752,000. Obviously, that doesn't get us to the $3 million mark. We do have some office space we're investigating leasing out, and we're going to be taking some of our double or semi-private rooms and making them into kind of like suites, so they're another market draw for people who may be having short-term rehab. It's a larger room. It'll have a TV, place for family to sit and visit, and there's a higher reimbursement for that.
Yeah, so how much money would that get you to?
We're still probably looking at anywhere from a $1 to $2 million deficit that we're going to have to work with the legislature and the administration to determine alternative sources of revenue to fill that gap.
The administration has suggested the possibility of a veterans lottery game or a percentage of break-open ticket sales going to the veterans home. Are those options on the table for you?
My understanding from our meeting yesterday, we had a representative from Budget and Finance Office, is that the administration is no longer looking into the tax on the break-open tickets or a lottery ticket. Not specifically sure what the other options are at this point, but they've kind of taken those two options off the table.
So given that you do have to then look to the state for financing, what are your hopes?
we're hoping that the legislature will help support the Vermont Veterans Home. Joe Krawczyk, the board president, and I, when we testified last year, said we would need approximately 25% of our total budget in general funds to support the Veterans Home. That's mainly because 80% of our costs are fixed. That's salaries and benefits, utilities, allotments to the state, the Medicaid bed tax. So it leaves us very little money out of our $20 million budget that we can control and close that gap. And my staff has done an incredible job of cross-saving measures and you know, looking at every opportunity to save money.
Are you confident that the state will continue to support the Veterans Home, given that there's a $100 million deficit in the state budget?
I am very confident. Governor Shumlin has always spoke highly of the Veterans Home and has been very supportive of us.
So you are confident that you will continue to get money from the general fund?
Yes.
The Veterans Home spent about $40,000 this year in a marketing campaign to try to fill beds and boost revenue. Are you feeling like this is simply a population problem? There aren't enough veterans, or there aren't enough veterans in Bennington to fill the space that you have?
First of all, the $40,000 was spent by the Board of Trustees. They have an endowment fund, and that money went to develop a marketing plan. So there wasn't actually money to fund many of the ideas in the plan. We've done a lot of research looking at a lot of statistics lately. The October 14, 2014 report from the VA Department of Actuaries shows that over the next 30 years nationwide, there is going to be a 7 million reduction in veterans. And, you know, everyone, we keep hearing when the Gulf War veterans come, you know, there'll be a higher demand. Even with the percentage of veterans who did serve in the Gulf War, there's still going to be this overall reduction over the next 30 years.
7 million, you said? There will be 7 million fewer veterans?
Yes. The other thing that is a challenge for us is we're one of four homes in Bennington County. We are probably one of the more overpopulated areas for nursing home beds. The average nursing home capacity in the state of Vermont as of October was 86%, meaning 86% of their beds were filled. Here in Bennington, it's about 77%, and we're at 73%. One of the things the board and I have talked about and we're working into our strategic plan is if we see that increase in Gulf War veterans or veterans in the future, Bennington is not the population center of Vermont. Burlington, Chittenden County would be a place to look at possibly 5-10 years down the road, building a satellite facility or a whole other veterans home to be right in the center of the population. No one wants to be 3 hours away from their loved one in the middle of December and try to get from Newport to Bennington if there's an emergency. And we understand and respect that.
Well, Melissa Jackson, when you think about the future, though, there's also, you know, there's a movement to age in place, that people want to stay at home as they grow older. Do you think that there's a change in culture going on as well?
Oh, definitely. We had a long conversation at the board meeting on this exact topic. The patients that we see today were patients who were in the hospital 5 years ago, and they're coming to us with far more medical needs and for short periods of time. We just had a resident pass away here who had been here for 20 years. We're not seeing that. You know, we're seeing 6 months for end-of-life care, 3 months because of my knee has been replaced, and people are returning home again. So there is, less of a demand for our services.
You are one of the largest employers in Bennington County, right?
So that is correct.
How is this decision that you mentioned, open positions that you won't be filling, how are the decisions that you're making going to affect the economy of the area?
The positions that we're not filling haven't been filled for quite a long period of time. We do have issues with recruiting nurses in the state of Vermont. You'll see that with the state hospital as well. So those are positions that haven't been filled, some of them for several years.
So you don't think this is likely to have a significant impact?
No, not a significant impact, no.
Are the decisions that you're making difficult ones for you to make? I mean, every business has to change and grow with the times and look at market forces, but you also are working with people. So is this difficult?
It is difficult. It's kind of, I wear two hats here. I have to ensure that our veterans get the highest quality of care and that we're here, you know, we're 130 years old, second oldest nursing home in the country, that we want to be here, you know, 130 years from now caring for our veterans. But I also realize I have employees that I need to take care of. And I also have a responsibility to the taxpayers of Vermont to run this as efficiently as possible. So those are all pretty, you know, tough challenges at the end of the day. You're not dealing with widgets, you're dealing with people. And we have incredible staff members here. They're all work very hard and have the veterans, you know, first and foremost in their thoughts.
So do you feel good about the decisions that have been made now?
I do. As hard as they are, we, you know, I know Joe Krawczyk, the board president, took some heat from this, but we have to run this like a business. Unfortunately, we cannot provide free care to every veteran. If that was possible, I would do that tomorrow. But knowing the pressures on us, we have to make those tough decisions to run this as efficiently as possible.
Melissa Jackson is the CEO of the Vermont Veterans Home. She's been telling us about some changes that are being made at the home to try to ensure financial stability moving forward. Melissa, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
That is it for today. Do you ever feel a little overwhelmed by all the email, texts, tweets, and Facebook updates in your life? Then why do you keep checking them? It turns out your brain gets a little bit of endorphins every time you get a new email. And on the next Vermont Edition, we'll dig into what science has to tell us about living a more organized life. More on science. Neuroscientist Daniel Levitin is our guest. Join us tomorrow for the program at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Mary Carol Magazzini. And Mary Williams directed the program today. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Mitch Wertley, been for Jane Lindholm, and thank you so much for listening.